Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, let's see here. Ted Kennedy, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, are they interested in fighting the war against Islamic terrorists or not? Is there a war against Islamic terrorists? Or is there a war against people whose country has been invaded, and they're saying, what are you doing here? George Landreth is with us. He's the president of Frontiers of Freedom, FF.org, the website. Also, he runs the website opeds.com. And he was booked with us through the American Conservative Union, conservative.org. I suppose any of those sites will get you similar information. George Landreth, welcome to the program.
It's good news, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. Great to have you here with us. You say when it comes to fighting and winning the war against Islamic terrorists, liberal Democrats like Ted Kennedy, Joe Biden, and Nancy Pelosi seem more interested in symbolism than substance. What do you mean?
Well, I think one of my concerns is the whole kind of notion of that there's going to be this micromanaging of using the tax, in other words, Congress has the ability to control spending. The president typically has the commander-in-chief and has the primary role in foreign policy. And the rub will come when the Congress says, but we don't want to spend any money on the war. And it seems to me that is, it sets a dangerous precedent. An example, just to put it in perspective, I wasn't necessarily a big fan of some of the things that militarily occurred during the Clinton administration, but I would have opposed, as a constitutional scholar, a Republican majority saying to him, you may be commander-in-chief, but you can't spend any money in Somalia, or you can't spend any money in Kosovo, or even more kind of offensive, you can't spend money to send diplomats to discuss Kyoto. You know, at some point, you know, that it seems that they take a legitimate power they have and they go too far with it in an attempt to manipulate or overreach and grab powers they don't rightfully have. And so, to me, the issue here is one of not looking at a particular policy, because, you know, if someone's against the war in Iraq, and they could say, oh, then I support this, or if they're for the war, then I'm against it. I'd prefer, as a constitutional scholar, to step back and say, let's ask ourselves, is this a good way to run things? Because it's easy to say, I like it because it gets the result I want. But
yeah,
then you have a precedent that creates a problem down the road for you, and maybe we ought to be more concerned about this, the process of it.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does, but there's a fundamental I have a fundamental confusion here, George Landreth. You represent yourself as a constitutional scholar. And, you know, I would never say that of myself, but I have read the Constitution.
Right.
And Article 1, you know, Section 1 of the Constitution, Section 1 of the Constitution, or Article 1 of the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
is all about the legislative branch, the
right.
House and the Senate. And it explicitly says that the House and Senate solely shall have the power to declare war.
Right.
It says that they solely shall have the power to raise and support armies, and that no appropriation of money shall be for more than 2 years, which clearly implies that they're required to exercise oversight over any sort of ongoing military operations that last more than 2 years.
Right.
That they are required to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. In other words, they're the ones who run the army. They're required to, this is section paragraph 15, to provide for calling forth the militia, to execute the laws of the nation, suppress insurrections and repel invasions,
right.
To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. I mean, you've got at least a third of section 8 of the Constitution,
right.
of the Article 1, which is called Powers Granted to Congress, has to do with their war powers. Now, with regard to the president as commander-in-chief, there is one sentence that
right.
says that he's the commander-in-chief of the military. And the purpose
yeah.
of that was to make sure that you had a civilian in charge of the military.
Correct. No, I agree with that, but I think...
So how can you say that Congress shouldn't be micromanaging war when the Constitution
historically, the way that's always been viewed, even and at the time it was written, this is that they were responsible for creating the rules, and so, for example, the military code, the procedures that they operate by are all, you know, produced in Congress. But the bottom line, I guess, is it has never been the case, and if you look throughout any war we fought, that where Congress took a kind of direct micromanaging role and used the power of the purse or its power to generally regulate, you know, procedures within the military, for example.
That was threatened during the Korean War, and had the election not brought Dwight Eisenhower into power, probably would have happened. It happened during the Vietnam War. The Congress did cut off funding for the Vietnam War. It was threatened for World War II before Pearl Harbor. Republicans were on the floor of the House saying that they would refuse, they would filibuster any attempt to authorize money to enter the war in Europe repeatedly.
Right, I understand that, and I think clearly when you're talking about when a war hasn't started yet, I think Congress, I think Congress is at its apex of power when it comes to war, when we are not currently in war, but contemplating it. I think the problem is once we're in a war, then you end up, Congress uses the power of the purse to kind of converge itself into, 535 mini commander-in-chiefs. And I think that's a bad idea. And I'm not just saying that because of George Bush. I mean, if we were getting back in time, we were talking about, President Johnson or President Clinton, I'd give you the same answer. And it's not because of a support of George Bush on this issue. It really has to do with just a question on how things go. Now, I understand that there have been times where people have threatened things in the past. It strikes me as they were acting politically and not in our best interest. An example is, you're right, we basically, Congress forced an issue in Vietnam and completely defunded, even once we pulled out, they completely defunded who was left to fight the battle. And then, of course, we got the result, which was a defeat.
Which arguably, I mean, you could say another result is that right now Vietnam is one of our trading partners and quite reasonable neighbor to its neighbors. In fact,
they stopped
the genocide in Cambodia that many would argue we started.
You could argue that, but we're obviously a great trading partner with Korea too, with South Korea, and
South Korea is a democracy.
Pardon me?
South Korea is a democracy.
Right, and we didn't completely abandon them. When we left, we continued to support them and to this day provide some level of support.
But we didn't occupy them. There's a huge difference. There is no country other than the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. There is no country that we occupied on an ongoing basis. The Philippines led to 42 years of continuous conflict. Actually, it's still going on. They just, Abu Saif, proved that this guy was killed last week. He killed an American just last year.
Right.
We're still fighting with the rebels, with the insurgents who,
Suggesting we should occupy. I mean, we occupied Europe for several years and things like that. But
we occupied Europe for less than a year.
Well, yeah, I suppose.
Then by that time, duly, ordained or whatever the right word is, governments had risen up and we gave them money through the Marshall Plan. We continued to have bases at their request, at their invitation. But we did not patrol the streets of Europe beyond that first year.
Well, there were American soldiers.
Arguably 2 years. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And I honestly disagree with that. 2 years is a little closer to what I.
Yeah.
I
stand corrected. Because my father was part of the occupation forces of Japan, and he left when the occupation was over, and it was about 2 years more or less.
My point is simply to suggest I'm not suggesting I think occupation is a good idea or that's helpful. Because first of all, I'm of the opinion that if you look at the U.S. military's history, when we engage the enemy in a conflict, we win. And we win hands down. We typically will win at relatively low cost.
But who's the enemy, George Landreth? Is it the people of Iraq?
Maybe before I get there, just explain. The problem is when we go to an occupation thing, we have much more, we're not really confronting the enemy as much as we're just trying to maintain peace. And that militaries are not police forces, and I think they perform poorly in that function.
Yeah,
and that's not to say that our military is performing poorly. It's just that when they are...
It's not a military function. I agree.
Exactly.
You need to stand up
like
a local domestic...
play linebacker.
Right, and it needs to be an indigenous domestic police department. Given that perspective, that you and I agree on the fact that an occupation is not something that's going to be successful, why are you supporting the ongoing occupation of Iraq? We won that war. Bush declared in May of 2003 that we had won the war. He was right. We won the war. And ever since that time, we have been occupying a country whose government we took down, whose buildings we occupied, whose army we disbanded, and that occupation has been totally destroyed. And you're upset that Congress wants to micromanage this? Bush certainly hasn't done a decent job with it.
Well, my sense of this would be as follows. My sense would be is we do need to leave as soon as practicable. But I think, and I think that the surge may actually allow that to happen sooner, because we need to, in my opinion, get them ready very, very quickly to take over. And my point is, if we were to precipitously leave tomorrow or next week, I think we would end up with, you know, a similar kind of, you know, I think it would just get worse, is my point.
No.
But I'm not someone who's going to stand here and say we should be there for five more years or even, you know, two more years.
On that point, we'll agree. George Landreth, Frontiers of Freedom, FF.org, the website. And the American Conservative Union, conservative.org, and opeds.com. Thanks, George.
Thanks.
16 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the radio support group of By and For We the People of the United States of America, 21 minutes past the hour, and of all living things on Earth, I'll put it right out there, I'm a peacenik. I believe in peace. I am committed to peace. And in my opinion, peace doesn't just mean no more humans killing humans. It means no more killing. It means no more destruction of the biosphere and the ecosphere and the planet and et cetera. And why am I going off into that? I don't know. Anyhow, well, because we've got this bloody war going on. We've got this lousy occupation, this absolute disaster that George W. Bush got us into solely for political purposes, solely because he thought it was going to get him, in my opinion, or largely because he thought it was going to get him political capital. I think from Bush's point of view, this was going to give him power, make him a wartime president, and give him political capital so that he could get his social agenda passed, which was deconstructing the New Deal, doing away with all the core tenets of the New Deal. And from the point of view of his neocon ideologue buddies, Richard Perle and Wolfowitz and Feith and all these guys, they all thought that the war would bring about a fundamental transformation of America's role in the world, maintain us as an empire. And, you know, tragically, it's had the exact opposite effect and will continue to. And from the point of view of Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice, who used to be on the board of directors of Chevron and had a tanker named after her, and Hamid Karzai, who was a consultant for was it Amoco, I think? I forget which oil company. One of the domestic oil companies that wanted to pump oil and run a gas pipeline across Afghanistan. For these guys, it was all about making money and all about, you know, that fundamental stuff. Richard Perle now saying we should attack Iran. He was in Israel over the weekend sitting in on a panel, and he said, asked if Bush would attack Iran before he leaves office. He says, would this president do it? Now, keep in mind, by the way, Richard Perle is one of the guys who told Bush, with regard to Saddam Hussein, that we're at a point of no return, you know, that we have to do it now, you've got to attack him now. He says, would this president do it? I think that until the day he leaves office, this is the president that, if he is told, Mr. President, you are at the point of no return, I have very little doubt that this president would order the necessary military action. Well, that's interesting. That Bush would only do it if he is told. That's probably a little more revealing a comment than Richard Perle had in mind. Over the weekend, all the talking heads out, Chuck Hagel on Face the Nation.
I served in Vietnam in 1968. Others did too. Jim Webb, John McCain, John Kerry, other members in the House. In 1968, when I was there with my brother, worst year, death, I would have welcomed the Congress of the United States to pay a little attention as to what was going on. I would have welcomed that. That is complete nonsense to say we're undercutting the support of the troops. What are we about? We are Article 1 of the Constitution. We are a co-equal branch of government. Are we not to participate? Are we not to say anything? Are we not to register our sense of where we're going in this country on foreign policy? Bottom line is this. Our young men and women and their families, these young men and women who are asked to fight and die, deserve a policy worthy of those sacrifices. I don't think we have one now.
That's Chuck Hagel, former voting machine company CEO, and now I think quickly becoming everyone's favorite Republican. I shiver as I say it, but nonetheless, Sam Brownback, on the other hand, on the Reich.
Last week you spoke out against the idea. What changed?
I went to Baghdad. I was there last week. I was there the week before last, rather. I met with the military officials. I met with the Sunni and Shiite leaders.
Now, Sam Brownback explaining why he opposes Bush's escalation of the war, but he won't go along with the Senate resolution opposing.
None of which really supported the idea. And then, the capstone on all of it was, I went to the Kurdish region. I went to Erbil and I met with Mr. Barzani, the head of the Kurdish region. And I asked him, will you send Kurdish troops, your Kurdish troops, into Baghdad to quell the violence? And he said, why should I get in the middle of the
situation? I thought they were doing that, though.
He's not sending the core of his troops. And I asked him, would you send, if you were me, would you vote for more troops? And he said, I don't see why you would do that at this point in time.
Senator Hagel has joined the Democrats in introducing a resolution to oppose the president's sending of more troops. Will you vote for that?
No, that doesn't give us a route forward. That just says, okay, we're against this. What I think we really have got to do today is sit down with Democrat leaders and say, what will you support?
Democrat leaders. Sam Brownback talking the talk, you know, getting those little talking points out there, using the language. You know, Frank Luntz and the whole thing. By the way, Frank Luntz will be with us in the second hour of our program. And Sarah Olson, a radio producer, independent journalist at editorandpublisher.com, will be with us in the third hour of the program about the Aaron Wetata case. Anyhow, it should be an interesting day. But this is, and then John McCain, of course, John McCain going out and saying, I think we should have 20,000 new troops. And so Bush says, okay, I'll see your 20,000, I'll raise you 1,500. I'll make it 21,500. This was a month ago or so. And so yesterday, McCain comes on Meet the Press and he says, Bush's proposal just isn't enough troops. Say what? And McCain wonders why he's starting to fall off the scale on the polls. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-440-8466, our number.
I'll take you there. I'll take you there.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, and we will be taking your calls in just one moment. First, let's just take a look at what the toll is, what's going on today with this ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq. And there we go.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the palace. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the rise.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 11:30 GMT on Monday, Dateline Baghdad, at least 67 people were killed and 142 people wounded when two car bombs exploded simultaneously at a secondhand goods market in Bab al-Sharij, a busy commercial district in central Baghdad. In Tal Afar, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed three policemen and wounded nine, including two policemen. In Mosul, a car bomb targeting an Iraqi army patrol killed a woman and wounded four people, including two soldiers on Sunday. Two more soldiers were killed when troops went to the scene to retrieve the casualties. In Mosul, the bodies of eight people were found on Sunday in different districts of that town. All had been shot. In Mahawil, police recovered the body of a man bound and shot from an irrigation canal on Sunday in that town of Mahawil, 50 miles south of Baghdad. Whew. Mark, driving in Virginia. Mark, you want to disagree with me? You go to the front of the line.
I got to make it real quick because I'm getting ready to go to a weigh station. They kind of frown upon phone use.
Okay.
Which would you rather have, though, the situation that we're in now, or let's flip the other coin. Let's say Kerry had gotten elected, and he wanted to give all of our nuclear technology to the Iranians.
Kerry did not want to give all our nuclear technology to the Iranians.
Well, that's what he came out on the television saying, so, I mean...
No, it's not what he came out on the television saying.
It's exactly what he said.
No, it is not.
He said that he wanted to quiet down the Iranians by giving them nuclear technology as long as they didn't use it to make a bomb.
What Kerry was talking about...
And the Iranians...
You realize, Mark, that the Iranians are signatories to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, and that according to the United Nations, they are in full compliance right now.
Well, I'm just telling you, the Iranians came out and said, hey, look, you know what? We don't want your help because you're not going to tell us how to make it, whatever it is we're going to make. We'll make our own power. We'll make our own bombs. We'll do whatever we want.
They're actually, unlike the Indians, the Indian government refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement. And arguably the most highly likely, and this isn't some liberal talking point, I mean, this is right across the board, ask any think tank, the most probable place where a nuclear war could happen is on the border between India and Pakistan around Kashmir. And India refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and George Bush just went over and gave them more nuclear technology. Pakistan refused to sign the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty and exploded a bomb. And what did we do? We made them our friend. They are the ones who are currently harboring Osama bin Laden. What do? We make them our friend. They are led by a guy who, by military coup, overthrew a democratically elected government and murdered many of the members of the democratically elected government. And what did Bush do? Made him our friend. Is there something I'm missing here, Mark?
No. I'm getting ready to go to a weigh station. I got to set my phone down. Okay.
I'll call back
later.
All righty. Thanks a lot for the call. 1-866-440-8466. With regard to Iran, I think the obvious and easy solution is you sit down and talk with them. And people are going, oh no, well you're not going to get anything from talking to people. Well, let's see. We didn't have a nuclear war with the Soviets for 50 years. We installed the hotline. We talked with them regularly. It seemed to work just fine. We sat down with North Korea. Bill Clinton sat down with North Korea and said, okay, you freeze your nuclear program, and we'll give you some food. Now, it was actually a pretty good deal. It cost us almost nothing compared to fighting a nuclear war with a Looney Tunes like Kim Jong-il. Walter in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Walter.
Good morning. It seems to me that there's a lot of misinformation out there that goes unchallenged about cutting off aid to Vietnam. At the end of the war there, and maybe you can set me straight, you know a lot more about history than I do, but from what I've read, the Case Church Amendment in 1973 cut off all funding for American operations there, but did not cut off military or economic aid to Vietnam.
To the government of South Vietnam.
Yeah.
Right.
And that, you know, during 1973 and 74, there was something on the order of $700 million in military aid that went to the Vietnamese and about $400 million in economic aid.
Yeah, and you could make the argument that what happened was the natural process of a civil war where one side didn't have the widespread support of the people across the countryside and lost, basically. And we were on the losing side.
Yeah, absolutely. According to the Paris Accords, the Americans were able to replace the military hardware and so on that the South Vietnamese expended, and they did that. And I mean, I've even read
several
that.
Times actually.
Pardon me?
Several times.
Yeah, yeah. Then they did more than that. I mean, the two governments they violated the accord on every occasion, and then when they did the strategic retreat in January, February 75 from the northern provinces, and then Ford made an appeal for more funding to help the South Vietnamese, but the South Vietnamese army just collapsed. I mean, the strategic retreat turned into a rout.
Yeah, and then the people basically vanished back into the villages. You know, they took off their uniforms and they said, I'm a farmer now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's.
And see, I think that that's what would happen in Iraq. I think that the Iraqi people, by and large, what you have right now are battles between Shiites and Sunnis who 10 years ago or maybe even 5 years ago, arguably even 5 years ago, were car mechanics and grocery store clerks. And they would much rather be car mechanics and grocery store clerks. And if we just got out of their face and got out of the way and let them sort out some rational political solution to this, and make sure that the oil money is divided up in a way that nobody feels like they're being really badly burned, and it looks like the Maliki government may actually be pulling that together, that there's a possibility that country could be stable. But you've got a whole bunch of interests in the region who are now saying, no, wait a minute. You got Iran saying, well, we're gonna back this, the Shiite majority. You've got Saudi Arabia saying we're backing the Sunni minority. I mean, this is starting to look like the countries of Europe looking at Serbia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire after Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated. I mean, it ain't a good thing. It just ain't a good thing. Walter, thank you for the call. John in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to, first of all, I read your book, Screwed, and I thought it was well laid out. I don't agree with all of it, but I really appreciate all you do.
Thank you.
I'm in the middle of Audacity of Hope by Barack Obama, and it reminds me of a couple of things number one being too many Democrats and liberals, et cetera, have decided for political reasons or whatever to continually say George Bush and his gang are well-meaning, believe in what they're doing, they're just, I just don't agree with them. The fact is, Stalin believed in what he was doing.
Yeah, so did Hitler.
Genghis Khan believed in what he was doing.
Yep.
Okay? I mean, we have to call these guys out. I mean, what they did last week to the prosecutors across this nation, or over the last few weeks, is classic fascist/Nazi move to solidify their power. That has nothing to do. It has nothing to do with meritocracy. It has nothing to do with.
No, it was the night of the long knives.
Absolutely. Yep. And they're solidifying their situation. It is, you can call it an aristocracy, and that's what it needs to be called. An aristocracy/monarchy at this point. And they're taking us all down that road. In fact, they were pretty honest about it. You were mentioning Pearl. I watched Pearl in a number of different interviews where these guys, these neocons, they don't consider us a democratic republic. They consider us an empire.
That's
and
right.
And they're
proudly using the word.
But thank you very much, Tom. Yeah. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, John. Thanks for calling. Richard in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Richard.
Hi, sir. I've been hollering today. I know you'll get better.
Thank you.
Your first guest there, wasn't there a misquote, misspeak there? I thought Clinton negotiated with Congress on both Bosnia and Somalia, and he was capped on the amount of...
You're absolutely right. He was.
He was
micromanaged by Congress, and Newt Gingrich in particular. Yes.
Yeah, the difference was he was honest about it. And went to them for the permission and the guidelines of what they wanted.
Yeah, well, I can't pretend to be a scholar of what happened during Bosnia. I've said before on this program, and in fact, Rich McClear, who runs our radio station up in our affiliate in Anchorage, Alaska, very often sends me notes after listening to me talk about it, saying, well, you got this one wrong, and you got that one right, but you got this one wrong, because he was actually there. He was in Serbia when a lot of that was going on. So he's right. I wasn't paying that much attention during that time, but I know that there have been many, many times in the history of this country, going all the way back to the Civil War, when Congress played a big role in defining what the role of the military was going to be. And spot on, Richard. And for these neocons to come out and say, oh, well, Congress should just shut up and go away. The president's commander in chief. I'm sorry. That's not a constitutional position, and it's not an American position. Just ain't. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. And welcome back, Transforming the World by Revitalizing Democracy.
Democracy, listener-supported radio here at the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen to the sponsors for your local show and let them know you're listening. It's a big deal. It really is. Also, our national sponsors, SacredGroundsCoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, SmallDog.com, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW, M-E-O-W. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. And Mark in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Tom, I was in a special operations unit during the time Clinton was in office. And
so you're probably paying much more careful attention than I was.
Yes, and I was in the area of Haiti when President Clinton put the troops in.
Okay.
And Congress restricted his plans and made him change the reconstruction plans for Haiti. And the biggest thing that I can see where they did that is when they went into Bosnia with the Dayton Accords, they made the U.S. military scale down its force package. And one of those things they made them get rid of was the air traffic control unit for Dubrovnik Airport. And Ron Brown's plane, the Secretary of Commerce, his plane crashed in Dubrovnik because there was no infrastructure there. And Congress, using the purse strings, made the president change his plan and reduce troop levels.
This would be the Republican-controlled Congress at the time.
Yes. I remember the senators lining up saying they did not want any nation building.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're dealing with landmines, when you're dealing with all this other stuff, and you're trying to do too much with too little, it just, you wonder what's going on. And what really was going on is that the Republicans did not want to spend the money to fund these initiatives.
Right.
But when it's their turn to be in the barrel, they want, you know, a blank check.
Well, right, yeah. Give no-bid contracts to Halliburton and Bechtel and all these other companies. But, yeah, interesting point. Mark, thank you very much. I didn't realize that about the control tower in Dubrovnik being defunded by the Republican Congress and then Ron Brown's plane crashed as a result of, or in part, possibly, as a result of that.
Well, they put the military unit in there afterwards.
Yeah.
But
that's interesting.
The Croatians in Dubrovnik had a control tower that had bullet holes in the glass. Mm. They had just visual with binoculars and no radar, communication system.
And he came in during weather.
Visual.
Yeah, he came in during weather. It's interesting. I'll be in Dubrovnik. In fact, in June of this year, we'll be doing our program live. I believe we'll be doing this program live from Dubrovnik. We're planning on that in June. So I'm looking forward to seeing that part of the world.
They have a beautiful farmer's market.
So I've heard. Mark, thank you very much for the call.
You bet.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Chris and Polyup. Polyup? Say it, Chris.
I don't know.
Puyallup. Thank you. Washington. Yeah. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, hey. Tom, I got a quick question and then a quick comment. I was debating with some of my Republican friends, which I love to do, and I used the fact that you had stated on your show a while back, and of course the argument always, oh, well, I don't believe that. And I've been trying to find that, and I can't, and it was the fact you said that in October of last year, I believe the people paid $9 billion in taxes and corporations paid zero. I've looked on your website, and I think you quoted it out of the Wall Street Journal. I tried to find it there, and I couldn't.
No, those are not the numbers. I did have it from the Wall Street Journal, and it was something like, and it was a quarterly number. It was for a quarter, and it was something like $89 billion for people and 9 or 19 for corporations. And
where could I find that?
Oh, man, I don't know. It was a little 2.5-inch story in the Wall Street Journal, and I just, you know, saw it that day and said, holy cow, and cut it out and ranted about it on the air. And you know, David might have stuck it in a box, but we emptied out the box a couple of weeks ago. So you'd have to, you know, if you've got a subscription to the Wall Street Journal, you could search it.
No, I tried to do it on their website, and that was it. You had to have the subscription.
Yeah, you gotta. So what you need to do is find somebody who has a subscription to the Wall Street Journal.
Exactly.
You know, who's letting you, who would, who, you know, you could go over to their house and log in or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just
okay.
always like
Sorry, Chris, but I'm quite confident that the personal numbers were in the 80s and the corporate numbers were in the teens or the below the teens. And nobody's disputing that that's the ratio, that a far less than even 25% of the total cost of the commons in the United States is being paid for by corporations and the rest by we the people. Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin, got about a minute before we have to wrap it up. What's in your mind?
I want you, sir, my great mentor, one of them, to write a book called Reagan's Cons. And I want you to say that he, which I believe, went to the communists, and he says, why don't you give it up? The only way your system will work is if we corporatize communism. And by corporatizing communism, then we'll be able to go incrementally towards corporate privatization, which ultimately will be economic,
ultimately it will be fascism, Armin.
No, beyond fascism, feudalism.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah, well, feudalism and fascism are variations on the same. This weekend I saw an amazing movie, Armin. You got to see this thing. It's called Pan's Labyrinth, and it's about fascist Spain. And don't take kids. It's rated R because there's some fairly straightforward violence in it, but it's just an amazing, amazing movie. If you want to really understand what Spanish, under Franco, what fascism means. And in fact, it was made in Spain, and the director said he was concerned that the younger generation was being told, that's in the past. We're not going to teach that anymore. We're not going to talk about that anymore. He said he doesn't want his nation to forget fascism. It's called Pan's Labyrinth. It was one of the best movies I've seen in probably a decade. An amazing, amazing movie. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up after the news at the top of the hour, Frank Luntz will be with us. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 6 minutes past the hour.
We have with us Dr. Frank Luntz, his new book, Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. Frank Luntz, welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There are a lot of people, myself included, who've worked in the advertising and marketing industry for years and years, who go out of their way to avoid particular clients or not do particular types of work because they have problems or issues with the morality of misleading people. How do you rationalize things like converting the estate tax into the death tax?
Oh, that one's easy. What causes that tax to be applied?
Well, there's a better question. What is that tax? If I have $5 million and I decide to give it to one of my kids, the first $10,000 is tax-free and everything after that is taxable. The inheritance, it's taxable, is fully taxable as income. If I die, that event forces that transfer of that wealth, but it's taxable actually at a much lower rate right now. But it's still my inheritance that's being passed along. It's the transfer of assets from one person to another. Whether a person is alive or dead.
If I die, that's the key word. If I die, that tax never happens 0% of the time, unless what?
No, that tax happens 100% of the time when a person transfers their assets from one person to another.
It's not called a death tax if you transfer your assets. It's only called a death tax when you die.
Right. If you do it when you die, you actually get a lower tax rate than if you do it while you're alive.
When you die, that's why it's a death tax.
No, it's a death. Come on, let's be honest here. It's a death tax because your polling found that people were more supportive of it when you called it a death tax than when you called it an inheritance tax.
It's why the Democrats created Medicaid as part of the Medicare package, because they realized people couldn't tell the difference between the two, even though the two programs are completely different.
So
it's why Armed Services was called what it was, And so I got in there.
So you're suggesting that any time language is used to deceive people, that's okay if it accomplishes your goals?
No, it's an issue of the same people. George Lakoff, I assume you've had him on your show.
I know George Lakoff.
George Lakoff does what I do. I don't think he does it as well, but he does what I do.
I would suggest to you that he doesn't. That George Lakoff, give me an example of George Lakoff using language to deliberately confuse people as opposed to illuminate them.
He had another name for the death tax that I thought was absolutely ridiculous. I'm trying to remember what it is. It's actually in the book somewhere. This is a guy who actually says to Democrats that they need to do what I do. And this stuff is in his book. And by the way, I read his book. It's interesting to me to watch how people who probably listen to your station will completely reject what comes out of the Republicans rather than trying to learn from it. Every time Lakoff produces a book, I buy it. Every time that Pelosi speaks on CNN or MSNBC or ABC, NBC, CBS, I watch it. I watch an hour of C-SPAN. I don't watch the Republicans speaking. I watch the Democrats speaking so that I can understand from their perspective. Go on Huffington Post today.
You know, in your book, Frank Luntz, how we got off on that. In your book, Frank Luntz, Words That Work, you suggest the complete works of George Orwell, or reading this essay, Politics and English Language by George Orwell. Orwell says in that essay, modern writing is at its worst is not consistent picking out words for the sake of their meaning and inventing images in order to make the meaning clearer. It consists in gumming together long strips of words, blah-de-blah, to produce sheer humbug, basically. Again, you've suggested that the word gaming should be used instead of the word gambling. Gaming is what you do when you're playing Scrabble. Gambling is what you do when there's money on the table. Why should language which conveys a different meaning to people be used when ultimately the goal is economic?
And your problem is with all of the people who go to Las Vegas.
No, my problem was with the use of language for economic purposes.
Everyone calls it gaming now. Everyone but you. Gaming has been part, if you read the book, it's been part of the lexicon now for 20 or 25 years. You're arguing over something that happened decades ago. I'm just merely describing the process by which it happened.
But it's not
an issue with language. I understand why people do. And by the way, there are clients that I have refused to work for because I did not morally believe. I've stayed out of the social issues because I don't want to get it. I don't think that any kind of messaging or language is helpful in that. I think most of the debates there are very destructive and very harsh, and I don't want any piece of it.
But issues where it comes to protecting or advancing the interests of the very wealthy and very powerful in this country, just fine with you. Is that because you believe in them or because they pay better?
Let me tell you this. I love democracy, and I love the free market system because I think it works for almost everybody, including you.
Democracy and the free market system are two different things, you realize. One is a political system, the other is an economic system.
You get a chance to do this interview because we have freedom of speech. You get a chance to be on the air because someone around you is making a profit. I assure you, if the owner of your station were losing money day after day and not making it someplace else, you wouldn't be on the air. That's the great thing about the free market system.
But back, I'm an advocate of both democracy and capitalism, too. We're not going to find any disagreement there. The question is, do you advocate for the most powerful and wealthy interests in this country? For example, the Walton family, who largely funded this whole death tax thing. Do you advocate for them because you believe in their cause? You believe that there should be an oligarchy, essentially, in the United States? Or do you do it because they pay better than anybody else?
Do you think there's something wrong with Walmart? Is that what you're telling me?
I am suggesting that the heirs of the Walton family financing a campaign to change the language around the inheritance tax so that the average person who will never be affected by it is caused to think that they will be affected by it, yes, is fundamentally immoral.
And what Walmart does and how it treats its employees, you're going to tell me is immoral.
I haven't brought up that issue. What I'm suggesting is what you're doing with regard to the inheritance tax, what you did with regard to the inheritance tax, calling it the death tax, is fundamentally immoral. And I'm curious if how you rationalize that. If you rationalize that as, well, you know, they pay the bills really well, and I need the money, and I want to raise my kids and have a good family, or that you think it's the right thing to do.
Because it's the death tax, because you're taxed when you die. And it bothers you so much that that term has really made its way into the public lexicon, because people looked at it and examined it and said, you know what? The tax only happens when people die, therefore I think it's a legitimate way. And now let me surprise you. I don't work with the Walton family. I'm one of the people who works for Wake Up Walmart because I have an issue with the way the Walmart Corporation behaves. I don't think they treat their employees correctly. I think their employees should get health care. I think that their time should not be moved from morning to night arbitrarily. I think that people have a right to a private life beyond what they work for in the public. I support the Nature Conservancy. I've done environmental work to ensure that there are still open spaces in America and that everything isn't built up.
And Hitler loved dogs. I mean, you know, we can...
So what you're saying is that I can never do enough for you because you've made a judgment because you don't like some of the language I've done.
What I'm saying is that the things that you're most famous for and the things that you brag about are those, the contract with America.
And you didn't even give me a chance to speak. That's the amazing thing.
Well, when you're filibustering me and we only have 2 minutes left, you know, by your definition.
I've done 4 interviews this morning and I've done about 15 on this book. And you have spoken longer in your questions than any other person who's interviewed me, including NPR, and by the way, including Air America, which I know you support.
Which I'm actually syndicated by. Perhaps I should consider that a badge of honor. I'm not sure. You said you have 10 minutes. If you want to make this a 30-minute interview, I'll let you filibuster me.
I don't, because I've got other stations that are more interested, instead of putting forward their point of view, they're more interested in learning more about the book.
Well, I'm really curious to find out how you... When you're taking these positions, justify it to yourself. Do you really believe it, or is it about being paid?
I absolutely believe in, as I said, which I know you don't, I believe in the free market system, and I'm going to help those companies that employ millions of Americans. I'm going to help them be successful in selling the products and selling their services. I'm going to make more things available to more Americans, more job opportunities. And I don't believe in the government. And so much of the stuff that I do is very hostile to government control. I believe in the free market when it comes to health. I believe in the free market when it comes to employment. And those are the things that I work for in my political work. And in my corporate work, I choose to work for corporations that I believe in. And I won't work, in fact, work against those corporations that I don't, such as Walmart.
Okay. Dr. Frank Luntz, his book, Works, Words That Work, it's not what you say, it's what people hear. Frank Luntz, thanks for being with us this morning.
My pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour, our number 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Your thoughts on Frank Luntz. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 21 minutes past the hour. TomHartman.com, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. I wrote about this in a book I wrote probably a decade ago called The Prophet's Way, which was largely about a path in the forest in Germany called The Prophet's Way. It wasn't, you know, me calling myself a prophet or anything about prophecy, but nonetheless, probably therefore wasn't the best title in the world for a book. But I wrote about this experience back in 1977. I was a partner in an ad agency in Michigan and working also for the American Marketing Centers, teaching advertising and marketing around the country, workshops and seminars.
and doing consulting work. And one of the jobs that we got, our largest client, we were a small company, and our largest client was one of the largest breakfast food manufacturers in the United States. And one of the jobs that we got that paid very, very well was to write, design, and produce a little booklet that went out to millions of school children all across America. Maybe tens of millions or hundreds of millions, I don't know. I mean, some huge number. That was scientifically entirely accurate, titled Sugar, the Essential Nutrient. And you know, they gave me the research. Yeah, if you go into hypoglycemia, if your blood sugar drops too low, you can die. You know, sugar is an essential nutrient. Now, you know, it didn't mention that it'll rot your teeth and that the main way that people get sugar is in by ingesting complex carbohydrates, which are broken down by the body in a normal, slow, gradual process. None of that, but, you know, anyhow, I wrote this thing. And my ration, and it went out. And my rationalization for the first couple of weeks after I finished was that, hey, it's the truth, and they paid a lot of money, and we had a four-year-old kid at the time and another one on the way, and we needed the money, and, you know, blah-de-blah. I had all these rationalizations, and it just finally broke down. And I looked at that booklet that I had written, and I just thought, you know, this is the point where I get to decide, where I have to decide, and it's already too late in a certain way because I did it, where I have to decide who I am and what I'm all about. And so in March of 1978, I got a call from a friend of mine who was one of the vice presidents of Holiday Inns at the time, Don Hoy. And he was in Germany visiting this social welfare organization, a program that had everything from hospitals to programs for abused kids to, you know, just a whole bunch of stuff all around the world. And he called up and he said, you got to come over here and meet this amazing man, Gottfried Mueller. And that, plus they need some help. They need somebody who knows advertising. And so on the next day, and literally it had been the day after I literally said a prayer, you know, God, give me something else to do. You know, I'm done with this. Hopped on a plane, went to Germany, was so impressed by what these people did. Put together a campaign for them. They came to the United States with an orchestra of 34 kids from this community for abused children in Germany. We set it up. They played Lincoln Center. They played the Berkeley Performance Center in Boston. They played Kennedy Center. I met with Ted Kennedy. He gave us a check for the organization. And we met with Andrew Young's wife, Jean Young, who was the head of the International Year of the Child. This was 1978. It was the International Year of the Child. Herr Mueller, the founder of the organization, spoke before the United Nations. He's now 93 years old. He's still alive. He's mostly the subject of my book, The Prophet's Way. And when it was all done, in March of 1978, we were sitting at the Watergate Hotel at this gala dinner, a fundraiser, that had been thrown for us by Celeste Holm and Meister Rostropovich. And I said, you know, I'm not going to bill you for the ad agency work that we did. And it was tens of thousands of dollars worth of work that we had done. And, you know, because I've had more fun doing this. This is just absolutely great. And Herr Mueller turned to me, and Louise was there with me. In fact, I'd flown home during the middle of this to deliver my son. And she was there with our middle child, nursing him at the table. He was like 2 weeks old, a week and a half old. And he turns to me and he says, why don't you sell your advertising business and do something worthwhile with your life? Join us. And I turned to Louise and I said, what do you think? And she was like, it's fine with me. And I thought back to that sugar, the essential nutrient brochure, and I said, you got it. We'll do it. And we moved to New Hampshire. We sold the ad business, or I sold my part of it. We moved to New Hampshire. We bought 130 acres of land on a 2,000-acre lake and created what is now one of New England's better communities for abused kids and schools for ADHD kids. And I'm just wondering, you know, what motivates people in that industry to do or not do things? 27 minutes past the hour.
I felt so good, like anything was possible. Hit cruise control, rub my eyes.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Or at least peace on this planet. How about peace? Rick in Richmond, California. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hey Rick.
It's interesting. I was I just finished reading The Prophet's Way. If I could talk about it a little aside for a moment.
Sure.
So it was cool to, actually I wanted to call you and talk to you, mention about that book at some point, and over the last month I've been reading it, and it was just kind of cool while I was on hold to hear you bring it up. So
well,
I enjoyed
you.
The book, and I wanted to say that.
Yeah, it's not a political book. It's not something that I very often talk about on the radio. But
yeah, I'd never heard you mention it by name before on the radio.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought you were really focused today with your debating of Frank Lutz.
Yeah, I kept remembering my Sugar the Essential Nutrient story and how I had to turn away from that. And when I went back into the advertising business back in the 1990s, we started an agency in Atlanta, and we did a lot of consulting for a lot of big companies. And I was always very, very clear that what I was about was teaching people how to do ethical communication, not just good communication, but ethical communication. And that, you know, whether they wanted it or not, that, you know, I was teaching ethics. And I just, it seemed to me like what he was doing was unethical, and so I thought I'd ask, you know, is that the case, and if so, why? And I think in the very, very end of the interview, we got the answer, which is that he doesn't think that it's unethical because it's anti-government and he doesn't like government. And I that would have made an interesting conversation, but he was unwilling to continue with me. He had said at the very beginning, you've got 10 minutes, period. And
did you notice those argument tricks that he used, like he was insulting you and he was trying to change the topic? And
oh, yeah. Yeah,
I think it might be interesting to break those down. It's, you know, at some point, maybe if you felt comfortable with the person.
Yeah, those are the things that they teach Republicans to do when they go on talk shows, and they actually work with the mainstream media. I mean, I heard him being interviewed by Terry Gross some time ago on National Public Radio, and he, as soon as she asked him a tough question, he said, "Well, obviously you're a liberal," and bang, she just shut up.
Yeah.
And you know, she's in a position where she essentially has to. I mean, this isn't a criticism of Terry Gross. She's supposed to be, you know, I think she views herself as a transparent interviewer, and she's frankly one of the very best in the business. She's brilliant at what she does.
Yeah, I found myself being tricked by him. And then when you came back to topic, I actually clapped in my living room because, you know, my mind had gone somewhere else and you drew me back. So I was really impressed.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate it. And thanks for the call. And thanks for listening, reading The Prophet's Way. Scott in Hensville, Washington. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Tom. Thanks a lot for taking my call. This guy, this Frank Lutz guy you were talking to, in my mind, is absolutely the kind of engine that keeps Bush and Cheney stories saleable in this country. For the common man like myself who's busting his ass to make a living and to take care of his kids, who doesn't really have a lot of time to find out the, quote, truth, people like this are the ones that weave the lies into fake truth and end up confusing us all. I thank you so much for talking to him. What a guy.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it, and thank you for your kind words. Gary in Modesto, California. Hey, Gary.
Hi. How are you today?
Tom's just great, but I'll get better. What's
up? Excellent. About Dr. Lutz,
yes.
He is being intellectually dishonest in saying that it's a death tax because it doesn't apply to all deaths, and it doesn't apply to death itself. It's a transfer of wealth.
That's right. And in fact, it's a tax on the people who are receiving it, not on the person who died. If I die, I'm not taxed. If I die and whatever I own is transferred to my kids, if that happens to be more than $2 million to each child, and no way it would be right now, but let's say it were, they would be paying a tax. They would be paying, and it's the same as the gift tax, basically. You know, the gift tax and the inheritance tax are two sides of the same coin, and it's a transfer of wealth from one person to another. The fact that it happens at death makes it an involuntary transfer of wealth, but nonetheless, that's what it is. It's a transfer of wealth.
Yes, it is. Thank you much for speaking to
me. You're welcome. Thank you.
Good.
Good to hear from you. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment on something Frank Lutz said, which is something that you've been saying has been part of the conservative worldview all along, And I couldn't believe I heard him say it, I don't believe in government.
Right.
And that means he doesn't believe in we the people. It has all sorts of implications. And ultimately, he believes, from what he was saying, in profit before people. Yet he can trick us all into not really seeing through what he's saying.
Yeah, and it would have been a, you know, unfortunately, he wasn't willing to stick around. I think it would have been a really fascinating conversation to drill a little deeper into that worldview and the philosophy that drove it, because an awful lot of deception has been done in the name of that worldview.
I agree, and I think that it's hard to, it would have been good, because it's really hard to pin down, and it's hard to believe that someone would say, I don't believe in government, flat out like that, as though it's a brag, although he didn't say it in that tone.
Yeah.
But there really is, I'd like maybe if you could explore at some point what it means when you say, I don't believe in government in this culture.
Sure. Well, my guess would be, first of all, that he didn't mean literally to say that, although I can't speak for Frank Lunson, won't try to, A, and B, I really try and make it a practice of not trashing people on the radio when they're not here to defend themselves. But broadly speaking, the people who say that they don't believe in government, what they're really saying is that they don't believe that government should provide any role beyond that of police. That there should
yes.
be an army and there should be police. And what they're reflecting is a worldview which says that humans are fundamentally evil and dishonest, and that we as a society, as a culture, have the only job that we have in terms of forming society, which is what government is. It's an instrument of our society. The only job that we have is to inhibit or limit that evil nature of humans. And the opposite worldview, the flip side worldview of that, is the liberal worldview, which was brought forward during the Enlightenment in the 1600s. And the children of the Enlightenment, the founders of this country, made into law, essentially, in the United States, which suggests that, in fact, that people are good at their core. And that, you know, by and large, that occasionally they get twisted and deformed and, you know, out of shape. But basically people are good at their core. And that the government should work together with people, as people. I mean, government is people. Government is us, we the people. That we the people can be trusted to govern ourselves. And that's something that I think read Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind, read the writings of William F. Buckley. I mean,
yeah.
That's something that Bill Kristol, that's something that conservatives fundamentally don't agree with. They believe that there should be a ruling elite, a meritocracy, and that ruling elite should be made up of the people who have been Darwinianly selected by virtue of wealth, typically, as demonstrating the greatest virtues. And, Kate, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom, for articulating that.
Yeah, good on you, and thanks for the call. And let me just continue this a little bit farther. The values that you find when you're looking at great wealth, it's funny, I was reading a Jack Vance science fiction story about this just over the weekend, called The Brains of Earth. It was amazing. Or The Brains of the Galaxy. The values, if your measure of the quality or value of a person is their wealth or the power that they've acquired. And you say, you know, hey, this is dirt. What you're going to have is a society that increasingly values wealth and power, and that increasingly becomes more and more coarse, more and more violent, more and more dominator-like, more and more warlike, more and more destructive, both to itself and to other societies around it and to the world itself. And I really think that there's something to be said for the idea of Rupert Sheldrake's idea of morphic resonance, you know, which is a fancy way of saying it, or Meister Eckhart, you know, back in the late 1500s, 1600s, you know, the German mystic who said, if the only prayer you ever say is thank you, that should suffice, that's enough. The idea that if we hold up and begin to practice, and there's actually an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal about this on Friday, I think, about the Dalai Lama, and the practice of compassion. If we begin to practice compassion, if we begin to put compassion into our law, if we begin to think of our brothers and sisters as our brothers and sisters, not just our human ones, that is a meme that takes hold and spreads throughout society. It's generative or self-generative. It grows itself. Similarly, if the main meme you put out is one of violence and vengeance, that is also generative. And to the extent that, you know, I'm always preaching here that power flows from the bottom up, there is also something that flows from the top down, and that's this tonality, for lack of a better word. And the Bush tonality is one of anger and hate and revenge, and I think it's doing tremendous harm to our society and to the world. Jay in Pittsburgh. Hey, Jay, we've got about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I had a couple of comments related to Mr. Luntz or Dr. Luntz and your conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple things struck me, and it was mostly about his tone and his technique, which one of your earlier callers talked about. The first thing is that he attacked you by implying that your questions were off base.
Right. And that's what he would use against Wolf Blitzer or Chris Matthews, and it would work because the mainstream media has to pretend that they're impartial. I don't have to pretend that I'm impartial.
Right. And the thing that he used was it's not unique at all. It's so common that he said nobody else asked me that.
Right.
Like, you know, he was accusing you of asking him or you talking too much and saying, well, NPR didn't ever ask me that.
Yeah. Yeah. How dare you?
Yeah, how dare you? Exactly.
Yeah.
How abrasive is that?
Yeah.
And
his last
statement was, "Do you want to hear about my book or don't you?"
Yeah.
Which I wish you'd have said, "No, I don't."
I did. It's a valuable and useful book, I think. Frankly, it's just I was just curious about the guy who wrote it as well. Jay, thank you for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. No, siree, Bob. Welcome back. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy here in the United States. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just a quick heads up. January 25th and 26th, that's Thursday and Friday of this week, I'll be in Washington, D.C. We'll be broadcasting live from the Mayflower Hotel, the Families USA Conference. I'll be doing a radio row with Talk Radio News Service. And this program, as I said, will be live there. And also Thursday night, January 25th, from 6 to 8 p.m., we'll have a press party. And party, it's open to the public. I'll be giving a talk on my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It, as well as a book signing. And there will be a bookseller there, a local bookstore that will be selling books as well. So if you're in the Washington, D.C. area and want to drop in and say hi, Mayflower Hotel, 6 p.m. Thursday night, January 25th. And then, of course, on Saturday is the giant march on Washington, D.C. Lonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Lonnie, some thoughts on Frank Luntz?
Yes, and I think he's a despicable human being. And I know you wouldn't say that, but
no, I wouldn't.
but the reason why I say that is he would hurry to define the reason for my saying that, because I disagree with him before I had a chance to give it, which is because he insists on defining everyone who asks him a challenging question with dripping contempt instead of letting them define themselves. But more importantly, instead of having a genuine question and answer or a conversation, and everything he accuses others of is merely classic projection. And I'm not a psychologist. I never studied it, but I do remember that. Mm-hmm. And I heard Terry Gross talk to him, too. And I don't know, do you remember his saying, it was like an Ann Coulteress juvenile complaint that Nancy Pelosi is a sacred cow because the public won't tolerate criticism of her, but everybody can tolerate Bush's being criticized. And yet I've heard a lot of ugly things said about Pelosi by the same people who mustered up their fake outrage with Barbara Boxer's comments about their sacred cow, Condi Rice.
Absolutely right. Lonnie, thank you very much. Well said, and I'll just leave it at that. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service from Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. The folks who are, in fact, putting on the radio row where I will be hanging out Thursday and Friday at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, look forward to seeing you there. Yes, the famous Mayflower Hotel, historic Mayflower Hotel. And Mayflower Hotel has good food and drink.
And I look forward to seeing your famous red hair flying in the wind. So
it will be there.
What's going on in Washington D.C.? It looks I just got this thing from Harry Reid's office that President Bush's health insurance proposal is a tax hike on working families.
Well, that's very interesting. I haven't seen that. I do know that that is, that along with health insurance, as I know you've talked about, is what he intends to talk about. He tends to talk about Iraq very little, even though the polls are showing, there's a Washington Post ABC News poll out today that is showing that the one issue that's of concern to Iraq by something like 48% of Americans is the issue.
Yeah.
All other issues were in the teens. Nothing was able to break out of the teens.
Well, I have a prediction about that, too. I predict that when he talks about Iraq, he will not talk, he will not use the word occupation, and
no.
He will not even specifically talk about the war in Iraq. He will frame it in the context of his so-called war on terror.
You're absolutely right. That is exactly what he's going to do. It will be part of the greater war.
Yeah, and terror? Excuse me? I mean, you know, there were 19 guys with box cutters who hijacked some airplanes. They was masterminded by a guy named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's sitting down in Guantanamo. And apparently that, the guy behind him was Osama bin Laden, who's sitting somewhere in Pakistan, probably having his feet washed at this very moment by beautiful maidens or something, you know. And, where is the rest of the terror? I'm sorry. I'm missing something here.
Well, I mean, my understanding is that there is terror going on. I think if you live in the UK, you've been subjected to some of it.
That was a couple of local guys. There was four. Ultimately, it was six or eight kids who were badly misguided, just like the Symbionese Liberation Army here in the United States. You know, with Patty Hearst. I mean, yes, you get a few wackos in a country, but that doesn't mean that an entire nation goes to war.
Well, this is one of the interesting questions. I think what you're saying is a very interesting point of view, but one that at this point is going to be frankly impossible to sell to the American people.
Because people want to have a war. They want to have an enemy.
I think partly that, but I think partly because they've already been sold the other, and to reject it, even though they'll reject Iraq now, to reject the whole idea of a war on terrorism as such and Osama bin Laden is too much.
Yeah, well, see, I have no problem with tracking down Osama bin Laden and bringing him to court and putting his butt in jail for the rest of his life if he's found guilty. But the idea that, I mean, you know, even England didn't go to war against the IRA. They dealt with the Irish Republican Army as criminals.
That's right.
And as such, they labeled them as criminals. They put them in prison. I mean, you know, those guys went on fasts in prison and things, but nonetheless, they were in prison. And ultimately what happened? The IRA came around. What you have are people who feel disempowered, people who don't want their country occupied, and you're not going to bomb them into submission. I just defy these guys to find any time in history when people have been bombed into submission. We have, you know, empire after empire after empire has fallen because it adhered to the fantasy that you can bomb people into submission.
Oh, you're suggesting somebody's reading history there.
Yeah, how dare I, especially with the Bushies, right? Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com is their website. Victoria, thank you for being with us
today. Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Rush Limbaugh. He'll want some. Got to keep it away from him, you know. He's dangerous with that stuff. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker named Jeff Gannon. That one's getting kind of old, isn't it? Yeah. Anyhow, 6 minutes past the hour. Sarah Olson is with us. FreePressWG.org, the website. FreePressWG.org. What is that, Sarah?
Well, that's a website that I've set up for people to track the developments in the case of the Army subpoenaing journalists to testify in the court-martial of U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watada.
That's marvelous. On my the prep notes I have here, I have editor and publisher.com. Apparently, we got that wrong.
Well, absolutely. I have published an op-ed that is kind of outlining my position. It's called Why I Object to Testifying Against Lieutenant Watada, and that can be found at Editor and Publisher.
Yeah, but freepresswg.org is the website. And,
sure does.
And WG as in working group, the Free Press Working Group. So we're talking with Sarah Olson. Sarah, you have an odd relationship, shall we say, right at this moment with the Bush administration and Mr. Gonzalez as a consequence of a professional relationship with First Lieutenant Aaron Watada. Thank you, LT.org, by the way, is the website for people who want to support him and his work. Tell us about how this all came about.
Sure. Well, what happened was that I did an interview with First Lieutenant Aaron Watada back in May. It was just before he became the first commissioned officer to refuse to deploy to Iraq. He's currently the highest ranking member of the military to do so and to, you know, kind of publicly hold a press conference and announce that he was not going to deploy to Iraq and to announce, you know, his reasons for not deploying.
Are there any other commissioned officers who have done this, or are they all non-commissioned?
His case is unique. Certainly there have been other officers who have, you know, decided to try to, you know, obviously there's the kind of numerous very high-ranking Army military officers who have spoken against the war. However, they were allowed to resign before, you know, they did that.
Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant Watada tried to resign several different times and was not allowed to do so. So he's really the only person who has done such a thing, in such a public way.
Right. Okay.
And,
interviewed him.
I interviewed him, and what happened was that, when the Army, Lieutenant Watada will be facing a court-martial coming up on February 5th. The Army has charged him with one count of missing troop movement. That's just basically not going to Iraq. And four counts of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. Each of those four charges are based on statements Lieutenant Watada made to the press or in public places regarding his opposition to the Iraq War. And in order to make those charges stick, the Army has subpoenaed myself and one other journalist to come into court and testify about our interviews with the lieutenant. They've also subpoenaed some anti-war activists and some other people. They've contacted a number of journalists and put them on the witness list. And, basically I have taken the position that it's not my job as a journalist to participate in the government prosecution of political speech. I think that doing so erodes the separation between the press and the government and turns journalists into the investigative arm of the government, into potential witnesses. And so, you know, kind of the question really becomes when you, you know, force a journalist to function in this way as the eyes and ears of the government, who's going to speak to the press? Who will be willing to come forward with their positions, with their thoughts, and speak to the press, particularly with regards to kind of dissenting or unpopular ideas? And certainly, the final part of it is that, you know, I think that this country as a, you know, democracy, a complex democracy, really requires journalists and the press to kind of foster debate and ask tough questions. And, you know, you really can't do that when the government is forcing you or trying to force you to, contribute to the silencing or the censorship of one particular perspective.
Mm-hmm. So, what's Sarah Olson, the website freepresswg as in working group .org, what's going to happen? You've been called to, you've been subpoenaed, right?
I've been subpoenaed to be up at Fort Lewis in Washington State between February 5th and February 9th.
that's the entirety of the time that they expect the Lieutenant Watada court-martial to last. And I think that, you know, it's not really clear. As I've been saying, I've certainly taken the position that this isn't something I should be forced to do. I'm hoping that the Army will drop their subpoenas of me and the other journalists involved. I think if they don't, then we'll just have to kind of take it as it comes. I'm also kind of saying that, there's radio recordings of my interview of it with Lieutenant Watada available, and, if the Army, feels that it needs to pursue these conduct unbecoming charges, they have other ways to do that.
Do you think this is part of a process by this administration to intimidate the press, Sarah Olson?
Well, a lot of people have asked that, and, I think that it's a point of fact that this administration is not friendly with the media. There's, numerous documented examples, and certainly, what is concerning to me is that there is, this is increasing. We all know about, there's this case with Lieutenant Watada. There's, the San Francisco Chronicle reporters who have been subpoenaed to testify in a grand jury. Currently, independent journalist and blogger Josh Wolf is languishing in prison on February, for not giving over his video outtakes. On February 6th, he will become the longest jailed journalist in history, jailed for not cooperating with a government subpoena to give over, protected or unpublished information.
So no other president in history has pushed it this hard or this far, and arguably no other president since, well, John Adams, obviously, with the Alien and Sedition Acts, and arguably Woodrow Wilson throwing people in prison under his sedition acts during World War I. Are there other examples of presidents who have behaved this way?
Well, it's helpful to point out that this isn't new. I think the people widely consider the first time that this happened to have been back, I think, in 1735. There's a really long history of people, of journalists going to prison to resist basically government attempts to meddle in the unfettered or free gathering of news. Mm-hmm. So it's not a new thing, but I certainly do think that it's concerning. I think that one of the things to consider is that if you don't hear about it on the radio or read about, or television or read about it in the papers, it's, how do you know what's going on? And certainly, we need more debate with regards to the Iraq War and not less. I think that there are...
But there was in the media virtually none leading up to it. I mean, there was maybe five or six dissenting voices versus hundreds and hundreds of, gung-ho, let's go get them. And the same thing is happening right now. We're hearing from all these so-called experts talking about Iran represents this great threat. And I don't hear anybody out there other than Scott Ritter, and nobody will interview him anymore, saying, hey, wait a minute. Iran is fully in compliance with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. They're fully in compliance with the United Nations. They're willing to allow inspectors in. They're willing to negotiate all this stuff. No, Iran is a threat. We don't talk to terrorists. Or we're not going to talk to them. I mean, it's bizarre. It's the drumbeat. There was an editorial about it, an op-ed piece in the Sunday New York Times. It's 2003 all over again.
Well, it's interesting. I heard Paul Rykoff, Iraq War veteran, speak a couple of, last week, and he is the author of the book Chasing Ghosts. Mm-hmm. He's also with Iraq and Afghan Veterans for America. But one of the things that he said was that he and many other veterans felt quite betrayed by the press in the run-up to the Iraq War, saying, that it was the responsibility of the press to ask tough questions and hold people, in power accountable. And he felt that the press had failed him and the veterans of the United States
by
not doing that.
You're a brave person, and I congratulate you for considering carefully what you're going to do here and for putting together this website, Free Press WG, as in working group, freepresswg.org, and for coming on the program. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good talking to you, Sarah. 16 minutes past the hour.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend. I'm not some daydream seller. I do not pretend. I've a sense of survival and screwing my rival that's labeled me crass and uncool. But I can't help it. I just tell the truth.
And welcome back to the radio support group of by and for we the people of the United States of America. Just a quick overview, kind of a best of the rest of the news here. Harvard researchers are now speaking out strongly against the White House. The White House Domestic Policy Council put out this report saying that researchers have figured out how to turn ordinary skin cells into what appear to be embryonic stem cells without having to use human eggs or make new human embryos in the process. And the people at Harvard write back. The authors of the Harvard study, they say, we're surprised to see our work on reprogramming adult stem cells used to support arguments that research involving human embryonic stem cells is unnecessary. On the contrary, we assert that human embryonic stem cells hold great promise to find new treatments. The work that we performed that we cited in the White House policy report is precisely the type of research that is currently being harmed by the president's arbitrary limitation on federal funding for human embryonic stem cell research. We feel that the president's restrictive policy has directly impeded research that provides a hope for cures of millions of Americans. The White House has clearly gotten it wrong, write the Harvard researchers. The overwhelming consensus in the scientific and medical community is that embryonic stem cell research holds the greatest potential to cure diseases and end the suffering of millions. Amazing. Meanwhile, this from the Wall Street Journal online, President Bush's signature foreign assistance program is likely to run out of money this year, leaving in the lurch several poor countries that have labored to meet its strict eligibility standards, according to aid officials. Yeah, after they gave themselves over to the neocons, right? John Warner is going to introduce a resolution opposing the Iraq escalation. Good on you, John Warner. And in the meantime, Iraqi assailants, the insurgents, the Iraqi citizens who don't want us there, they've upped the ante. They're dressing up now not as Iraqi army, but as U.S. Army. They're wearing what appear to be American military uniforms in an effort to impersonate American soldiers. This is the New York Times today. Wearing what appear to be American military uniforms in an effort to impersonate U.S. soldiers. Boy, it is, excuse me, it is really, really getting bad. Dan in Placidas, New Mexico. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks a lot. This is Dan in Placidas. I had just read an article that really kind of caught my attention yesterday. It said how Congress can stop the Iran attack or be complicit in nuclear war crimes. It was on the January 20th Information Clearinghouse by Jorge Hirsch. That's not Seymour, but Jorge, he's a physicist down there in University of California in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And he kind of did some tactical thinking here that I think is pretty impressive. It's he's saying that if Congress would simply pass a bill that says that the U.S. can't use nuclear weapons against countries that don't have nuclear weapons, and read Iran in there, and that could be possibly passed with a veto-proof majority, that would put a stop possibly to Bush's plan, because
yeah, the kicker is the veto-proof majority, Dan, or the filibuster-proof majority in the Senate.
Right, but what he's proposing is something that it would be hard for a lot of Republicans to go against that, to say that openly that they are in favor of using nuclear weapons against a country that doesn't have nuclear weapons. And we've never done this since nobody's ever
since,
done
well,
this before.
Well, since Japan.
Nagasaki.
Right.
And so he has on the site, he's got a
he's got a copy of a proposed bill that's been vetted by lawyers and so on. A lot of good information. I have gone ahead and sent a letter and a copy of the proposed legislation to our congressional delegation here in this is the birthplace of the atomic bomb. And I'm going up to the legislature here in Santa Fe tomorrow morning, and I'm going to sit down in front of Governor Richardson's office and ask him, would he support legislation in the U.S. Congress that would outlaw the use of nuclear weapons against countries that do not have nuclear weapons? Yes or no, Governor Richardson?
Good on you, Dan.
And
good
on you. That's my plan. So
okay.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we'll see how it shakes out. Good on you. I appreciate the call. Guy in Seattle. Hey, Guy, quick one.
Yeah, I got a quick one for you, Tom. Kind of on your Dr. Luntz and the death tax perspective. This guy has got to be the dark side of the ad business. And the words that come to mind when I think of his effort, justificationist and distortionist. This guy can twist words like you'd never believe.
Yeah.
And
well,
by the way, I'm going to let you off the hook on the sugar thing. Sugar is an essential nutrient. It's the corn sugar that the pancreas cannot handle.
Yeah, I agree with you, Guy, and I think it's a major, major health problem. And, yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe Frank just got a call, and on the other end was Dick Cheney saying,
you don't know the power of the dark side.
Nah, and he says, anyhow, 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
I lived with them on Montague Street in a basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air. Hell, he started in the dealing with slaves and something inside of him died. She had to sell everything she owned and froze up inside. And when it all came crashing down, I became withdrawn. The only thing I knew how to do was keep on keeping on like a bird that flew. Kinda like in blue.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is from Media Matters for America. In his January 20th column, nationally syndicated columnist Robert D. Novak wrote that former Clinton advisor Dick Morris is asking for a contribution between $25 and $100 or more to finance a critical film documentary of Senator Hillary Clinton. According to Novak, in a mailing sent out by the Presidential Coalition, a group run by Republican activist and discredited former congressional staffer David Bossie, Morris wrote, quote, this is Dick Morris, quote, if you liked how the Swift Boat veterans turned the tide against John Kerry, you understand how a top Clinton aide can turn the tables and stop a Clinton-style liberal from becoming the next president of the United States. End a quote from Dick Morris. Amazing. Most recently, they note, Morris falsely claimed that Barack Obama voted against an amendment to a Senate ethics reform bill. In fact, he voted for it. Swift Boats for Veterans for Truth conducted a smear campaign against John Kerry that was false in most of its assertions, certainly its implications. In addition to his syndicated column, Morris appears frequently on Fox News as a so-called political analyst. He was on this program back in 2005, 2 years ago, and promoting his book about how Hillary Clinton was going to go up against Condi Rice for president in 2008. And I had him on the program, and several times he would be trashing Hillary Clinton on personal things, and I just kept saying, you know, let's keep it off personal stuff. Let's talk about the issues. And, you know, finally he takes a slap at Sandy Berger, and so I just tossed one back at him, and he freaked out. But here, you may find this interesting. Dick Morris, he's talking about Condoleezza Rice here as we start out, and then he gets into attacking Hillary Clinton.
And I think that the only way that she can be defeated is by another woman. And I think in particular a black woman who could take a piece of the African-American vote. And in my book, I lay out that thesis, and I explain about why I think Rice would be a superb president. And I point out, for example, the accomplishments of the last 7 months as Secretary of State, when she's really been on her own, just getting North Korea to agree to abstain from production of nuclear weapons, getting the Sunnis to participate in the Constitution and in the elections in Iraq, getting France to join the United States and indeed lead in pressuring its former colony, Syria. And I point out, for example, the economy in pressuring.
Yeah, yeah. Alex, are you playing it?
In pressuring.
It's not working. Okay, I'll continue with.
From Sarah, getting a united global coalition.
I'm hearing it coming from you, Alex.
Anymore, but with other countries to pressure Iran not to develop the bomb. I think that this has just been an extraordinary series of achievements. And I think Hillary's achievements in the Senate have been minimal. Almost every bill she's passed has just been symbolic of that.
Well, actually, the language that you used in the book was that every bill that she had sponsored, you attacked her for co-sponsoring legislation, which you said that doesn't much matter if you only co-sponsor it.
Right.
She had not sponsored legislation that you thought was of consequence.
Almost every bill has about 30 co-sponsors on it in the Senate. It's not meaningful.
And
the bills she introduced, there are only 7 that are anyway substantive, and 3 of them were 9/11 bills that everybody...
But Dick Morris, Condi Rice, you point out in the book, in fact, the phrase you use is that Condi Rice is the creation of George W. Bush, and that she basically, you know, she's his protege.
Well, I don't use that phrase in the book, and I don't think it's true. She's not a creation of Bush.
I just read it 10 minutes ago.
No, I don't use the word creation of Bush. I think that Bush influenced her, and she influenced Bush. But this woman is hardly the creation of anybody. She was a principal negotiator in dealing with German reunification when she was 34 years old, in negotiating one-on-one with Gorbachev while Bush was still drinking. There was no relationship at that point. At Stanford, she was the provost of the university and one of the leaders in raising education standards at one of the top 10 universities.
And nowhere, and you're not in the book dealing with her absolute and utter failures to deal with national security in the United States. Her main job was to protect this country, and she failed. We had 9/11. We were attacked. She was getting all kinds of warnings. You don't even talk about that in this book.
The effort, she was national security advisor for 8 months.
Right, Sandy Berger told me personally, Dick, that he told Condi Rice when she came into office that his words to her were, look out for Osama bin Laden, he's coming to get you, you need to be paying attention to this, this has to be your number one priority, and she said, okay, thank you very much for that information, and then did nothing.
Did he take the document out of his socks when he told you that?
Come on, Dick. do you want me to talk about hookers with you? I mean, come on, Dick.
Okay, well, thanks very much for the interview. Bye-bye.
And at that point, Dick Morris hung up on me because he got fired from the Clinton administration for being caught with a hooker. And the point was, you know, if you want to do personal attacks, I know how to do personal attacks, but I don't think that there's any value in it. But anyhow, Dick Morris has come out and now said that he's going to go into personal attacks big time. This is going to be his major mode of operation. Again, quoting Dick Morris. And this, you can find this over Media Matters for America. This is Robert Novak, actually, writing about this. Quoting Dick Morris, quote, if you liked how the Swift Boat veterans turned the tide against John Kerry, you understand how a top Clinton aide can turn the tables and stop a Clinton-style liberal from becoming the next president of the United States. End quote. And I asked Victoria Jones about this morning. I said, do you think he's going to raise the money? And she said, in a heartbeat. No problem at all. It'll be easy for him. So, anyway, that's what's up with that. 1-866-440-8466. Tom in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Appreciate you taking my call. I have the opportunity to go to Tehran here in the next month to spend a month there. I'm a sculptor, and I've been invited to go to a sculpture symposium over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the dilemma I'm facing right now with everything that's going on with in that area is, would it be smart to go there? You know, I've just read Scott Ritter's book, Target Iran,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, have that background to the whole scenario over there. The fact that Iran is now, pushing ahead with nuclear, with the
fuel enrichment. Nuclear program, and now starting to test missiles that have a range and possibly reaching Israel. It's a little scary, and I'm wondering, would you go if you were me?
Probably not for a month. The reason why is because if you read Scott Ritter's book, you know, I'm assuming what's in it. I haven't read his book, but, you know, we've interviewed him on this program two or three times about it, and I'm assuming that the interviews are congruent with the book. And what he has said is that there's this window of opportunity. In fact, he said on this program the same thing about Iraq before the Iraqi invasion, that Bush would be invading Iraq in somewhere between the middle of late February and the no later than the middle of April. And I said, why? And he said, because the moon is right and the weather is right, and there's a very narrow window of time when all of these conditions, you know, are perfect for that kind of a military operation. And being an old Marine, Scott Ritter knows about that stuff. And he's now saying the same thing about Iran. He's saying that Bush is going to attack Iran in March or April. And so look out. So I would be, I certainly can't advise you, but I would be very wary of going to Tehran in March or April.
That's been my feeling. And a friend of mine who would be going over with me said, we should trust our gut feeling here. Because it's difficult, of course, who can tell the future anyway? There's no foretelling here. And that's...
Well, and the other problem is, look at the U.S. hostages, the U.S. embassy and personnel, you know, in Iran. When there's some form of hostilities, I mean, if Bush starts a war against Iran, you may be everybody's friend until that day, and the next day you're suddenly a hostage. I mean this is a part of the world where things turn on a dime, and on the other hand, I can see the appeal of it. I mean, I would have no hesitation now or probably through most of February of taking a weekend visit to Tehran, but for a month, I don't think so. Tom, I got to move along. I appreciate the call, though.
Hey, I appreciate it, Tom. Thanks.
Good luck. Good luck making up your mind there. David in San Francisco, listening on the Quake. Hey, David.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I heard your little chat with Dick Morris, and it's always been a kind of surprise to me that he's gotten, credentials through Clinton and whatnot. I don't know if you know it, but he's Roy Cohen's nephew. And, Roy Cohen, if people aren't, many listeners aren't old enough, Roy Cohen was involved with the House Un-American Activities.
Joe McCarthy.
Yeah, and whether or not Clinton thought that he could get involved with New York politics through Dick Morris, maybe that was his logic, but apparently Dick Morris doesn't have any sway in New York anymore because Hillary is now the senator. So.
Yeah, amazing. David, thank you for that little factoid. That's fascinating. I appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Have a nice day.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. A place where smart people get their news. Welcome. Speaking of which, typically our chat room, which you can get to by going to TomHartman.com and clicking live chat up at the top of the page. Typically it is one of those extraordinary little spots of incredible intellectual discourse. Deep thought. Great ponderings. I get a lot of folks will point out articles there that, hey, you ought to talk about this. Think about this. And there's a lot of good, useful information. For example, just got one link. This was just 32 minutes ago. The Associated Press posted this. Iran bars 38 UN IAEA inspectors. This, I'm telling you, this is a replay of Iraq. Iran said Monday it has barred 38 members of the UN nuclear inspection team from entering the country in what appeared to be retaliation for sanctions imposed last month over its contentious atomic program. Foreign Minister Manaukher Mottaki said some inspectors were admitted, but maintained that Iran could decide who should be turned away. The IAEA submits a long list of inspectors to member countries, and the countries have the right to oppose the visit by some inspectors. So apparently what's happened is the IAEA says, okay, here's a list of 100 names. And they say, okay, you can send this guy and this guy and this guy, but not that guy and not that guy. Because we think that guy's a U.S. spy. Or we think this guy is, you know, or whatever. And so apparently they're allowing some inspectors in, and this what this article doesn't say is whether they're allowing in all of the, you know, in other words, it's sort of like, is it like jury duty where you know, 100 people are put forward, 25 are actually going to go into the country, and the country gets to say, okay, out of these 100 people, here's 35 we don't want, and then you can send 25 of whoever else you want? Or is it a situation where the IAEA says, you know, we want to send 40 people, and Iran just said, you can send two of them, but the other 38, no. And the article doesn't lay that out. And it's going to be interesting to see how this is played in the American media. I'm sure the American media will probably play it as the Iran has simply banned members of the UNIAEA. May or may not be the case. If so, they probably should be condemned for it, but that's almost beside the point. This, in my opinion, this is one of those Saddam Hussein moments. Now, anyhow, as I was talking about the chat room, so I'm guessing it was probably Sue Nethercutt who runs our chat room, found an emoticon, one of these little visuals, one of these little graphics that is a smiling face that rolls from side to side. And everybody's like posting them. And so the whole thing is like filled with these little rolling smiley faces. Like, wow, wait a minute. El Cid also wants to, from our chat room, wants me to point out, this was in Sunday's paper in the New York Times. The government of President Alvaro Uribe, the largest recipient of American aid outside the Middle East, this is Colombia, has found itself ensnared in a widening scandal as revelations surface of a secret alliance between some of the president's most prominent political supporters and paramilitary death squads. It seems that the guy who is the president of the country that is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid outside of the Middle East is running or is associated with people who are running death squads in Colombia. Some 30,000 paramilitary members have been demobilized during his recent years. He still receives more than $700 million a year in aid. And close to, now they're saying, as I recall, close to 10,000 people may have been put to death by these death squads. And this is pretty startling stuff. I've been and worked in Colombia. And it is not a friendly place, shall we say, at the very least. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Tom. First of all, I was at your book signing in Pittsburgh, and I very much enjoy listening to you. But you made a mistake earlier when you said the British criminalized the IRA, and that brought them to the table. It actually was the reverse that happened. When Margaret Thatcher criminalized the IRA, they went on a blanket protest and the hunger strike of 1981, in which 10 people starved. After that, they reversed themselves.
They decriminalized the IRA and allowed Sinn Féin.
Yes, and they decided then, after the hunger strike, that they better talk to Sinn Féin, because the people then even supported the goals of Sinn Féin and nationalism even more, and so that brought them to the peace table.
Yeah, you're right, Jim. I stand corrected. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I love your show.
You're welcome. My main point, though, I think, the details aside, sometimes that's the devil's in the details. My main point was that you don't deal with, it's like trying to deal with Tim McVeigh as if he was, you know, a sovereign nation. Let's declare war against terror after Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma. I mean, it would have made no sense. And Bill Clinton pursued him as a criminal, prosecuted him as a criminal, put him in prison as a criminal, put him to death as a criminal. And everybody looked at him and said, he's a criminal. And anybody who might have been inclined to associate with him said, I don't want to hang out with that guy. He's a criminal. And when Osama bin Laden, theoretically, I mean, you know, this is the broad consensus, when Osama bin Laden knocked down the Twin Towers, the whole world was looking at him like he was a criminal. And Afghanistan was saying, we'll hand this guy over to a neutral third country for a trial. And they were willing to shut down Al-Qaeda. And it could have been the end of the whole thing. But Bush had to have a war. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, the top news of the day, plus Congressman Jim McDermott is here, his most recent trip to the Middle East. And I'll be mixing it up with Jack Thomas, who says the ACLU is not normal, pursuing the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Services for racial profiling. That and your and more on your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.